There was no time to memorize any of them. I shoved them back into the manila folder. My thoughts were rattled, and I pulled what I could remember about proper protocol with a powerful vampire to the forefront of my memories. I needed excellent manners, a calm attitude, and the ability to play conversational chess, thinking ahead a dozen moves or so. And if Ming had ordered the shooting, there was nothing I could do. Vamps were policed by their upline boss, which in Knoxville meant Ming of Glass, and Ming could be judged and punished only by the master of the city of New Orleans, Leo Pellissier, her upline master, or any vampire who managed to challenge her to a blood duel, or any non-law enforcement human who got close enough to stake her and managed to survive. The position of vampires as regarded by law enforcement was hazy. "No," Tandy said. "You'll be fine. Just remember, be polite and never, ever meet her eyes." "That's good advice," I whispered, and cleared my throat when the words came out like busted gravel. We passed through the bedroom and into a sitting room where Tandy opened the door on the far side. The small room beyond was set up as an office, decorated with heavy draperies, heavier rugs over wood floors, dark wood wainscoting, a leather sofa, two leather armchairs, and a desk the size of Minnesota. Well, not really, but it was huge, oversized for the small office. Ming and Yummy were sitting in the armchairs, Ming upright as a board, Yummy stretched out with a leg over the chair arm. The blonde vampire looked relaxed, but her position shielded Ming from the doorway and allowed Yummy to roll down to the floor in the event of an attack. The position would fall below any gunshots and give her plenty of room to strike and take out an opponent. As a vampire, she had the speed to cross the distance and take out a human shooter in an eye blink. Any bullets wouldn't hurt her anyway unless they were silver. Ming was positioned to roll under the massive desk into relative safety. Tandy paused near the desk and the recording device centered on it. I stopped to the side of Ming, carefully, not between Yummy and her charge. Tandy said,
"It's standard operating procedure for us to record this conversation. Do you have objections, Ming of Glass?"
Ming waved a hand, the motion languid.
"I have no objection."
Tandy pushed a button and stated the day and time, the address, and the location of the house. He said,
"Special Agents Tom Andrew Dyson and Nell Nicholson Ingram, with Ming of Glass and one member of her security. Would you state your name, miss?"
he asked.
"No,"
Yummy said. Tandy went red. I wanted to giggle, and all the fear drained out of me. The vamps were playing games with Psy-Led. I decided it was not the right time to engage, or I'd be playing the game they wanted to play. Not one of my own. There are things a girl learns listening to the squabbles of an extended family. Timing is one of them. "Ming of Glass," I said, "I am honored to speak with you. I'm Special Agent Nell Ingram of Psy-Led." As if to remind her, Yummy said,
"Maggots, my master." "This is the one, then."
She turned black eyes on me, and it was like being hit with a paralysis spell. I froze, like a rabbit in the gaze of a hawk. I didn't want to move. At all. Ming was Asian and old, even as vampires go. Vampires tended to show less expression as they aged, and the term inscrutable fit them all. With Ming, it was inscrutable, unfathomable, and indecipherable times three. Usually. Right now, her tone held a warning of some kind, and I broke into a sweat, which I knew she could smell. Nervous sweat, even the giggly kind, was a foolish thing in the presence of an apex predator. It spoke of prey, and I knew I had lost face already. I stepped behind the desk, sat, sighed. "I ask forgiveness for all insult, Ming of Glass. None was intended." I opened the folder. It was supposed to be a sign that the topic of maggots was ended. I'd like to ask, do you feel maggots in our presence at this time? Ming interrupted. I thought about timing and vampire games. I'd studied some in spook school. Sometimes letting them swim on the line worked. Or truth. I was better with truth. And wood. I gripped the wood desktop and sank my fingernails into it, shoving past the finished surface into the grain, damaging the fine furniture, but touching bare wood. It was soothing. The tree had been large, old and beautiful. Teak. Even dead, it was full of power I could use. I drew on the remembered life in the dead tree, and I stared her straight in the eyes. Mithrans aren't used to humans doing that, especially humans who had dealt with them before. Like law enforcement. Vamps mesmerize with their eyes. Instead, Ming blinked. Not exactly, ma'am, I said. Only when I walk where Mithrans have walked for a long time, on wood or on the earth, and with my bare feet, do I feel the presence of their undeath. Ming stared back at me, hard. Nothing happened. And are your feet bare now? She asked. They are not, I said, knowing that was when this line of questioning was turned from speech to text and entered into the official record. I'd be teased about it, which Ming surely knew. And the maggots, she pressed, her tone arch. Ming of Glass was pushing me, testing me the way a cat did a mouse she might eat, except she was bored and the mouse was a game. My voice hardened, and I let a little church into my words. I stepped in a dead possum when I was a child, barefooted in the woods. It was cold and slick and crawling with maggots. That sensation stayed with me. I insulted Mithrans when I mentioned that at a time when I was rattled, insecure, and unwise. Again, I offer apologies. Accepted. But before we continue, did you feel maggots in the yard where the shooter stood? She was asking if the shooter was a bloodsucker. I took in a breath, putting the questions together with the events of tonight. She was asking if there might be a strange vampire in town gunning for her. Or someone in her ranks trying to take her out, outside of vampire protocols. Or trying to stir up trouble for the head vampire in Knoxville. I had heard of vampire wars. That would not be happening. Psy-Led was putting together a protocol for dealing with that sort of situation. Bloodsuckers rampaging in the streets. And rumor suggested that the protocol involved killing vamps on sight. Which I was sure Ming did not know. There were no Mithrans in the yard. May we proceed? I asked, keeping my expression wooden and my scent pattern muted. Of course, Ming said, no hint of amusement in her tone now, and her eyes hard as steel. I released the wood of the desk and handed the paper that was traced with the floor plan of the game room to Tandy and indicated Ming. He carried it to her. I said, would you both please show Special Agent Dyson where you were standing at the time of the shooting? I set the other sketch, the one with the positions of the people already in place, on the desktop and scanned the list of questions. Tandy handed the sketch back to me, with two fingers marking spots near where the first round had come through. I compared them to the locations given by the other guests. It matched the locations where someone else had placed them both. It also suggested that the shooter had been aiming at them and missed. Mithrans have much better eyesight than humans, I said, and a much better sense of smell and hearing. Did you see, smell, or hear anyone outside the window prior to the onset of the shooting? Nothing, Ming said. There was something pleased in her tone, as if she liked either the question I asked or the exchange we'd just had. Maybe she was less inscrutable than I thought. Yummy shook her head.
Me neither. I was watching the people inside the room. We didn't bring outside security, depending on the team hired by the Holloways. That won't happen again.
Ming said,
We will not insult a host with such actions.
With all due respect, my mistress, Kai has already said otherwise. You and your primo will have this discussion, not you and me.
You are cheeky,
Ming said, but she didn't sound upset about that. Maybe Ming lacked cheeky. I filed that away for future reference. I said, And to whom were you speaking at the time of the first shots?
The party was a fundraiser for Senator Abrams Tolliver, and also an opportunity to make business deals. I was speaking to Senator Tolliver himself when the first shots were fired, though my body was between him and the window.
Which again insinuated that she was target.
Would you walk me through the sequence of events from just before the first shot until the police came? I asked.
I was speaking to the senator. I heard a shot. I moved. My security did not deem me as moving fast enough nor far enough away from the violence. She lifted me and moved me faster.
Again, there was a wry tone in Ming's voice. In ordinary circumstances, ones without emotional components, Ming's voice gave away more than her expressions.
She deposited me in the butler's pantry. On the floor.
Ming turned her gaze to Yummy. Yummy looked back at her and, without emotion, said,
You are welcome, my mistress.
This meant that Yummy could move faster than a master vampire. That was interesting. I wished I could remember Yummy's real name. Yummy was the nickname given to her by Jane Yellowrock, the vampire hunter who worked for the vampires in New Orleans. I couldn't remember anything else about Yummy, except that she had been part of Jane's team the night Jane raided the compound of God's Cloud of Glory Church to find and save a kidnapped vampire. Yummy continued, almost implacable as Ming herself.
There was a fire, my mistress. Mithrins are flammable.
I nearly choked on the flammable comment. Yummy went on.
You were safe where I placed you. Kai is pleased.
From Yummy's tone, that subject was now closed. Kai, Ming's primo blood servant, was the ultimate authority, and Yummy reported to Kai, not Ming.
More interesting.
Ming met my eyes again and said,
I remained on the floor until I was helped to my feet by a properly deferential human. I do not know his name, but he was wearing a black shirt with brown pants. A name tag hung from his shirt. He assisted me into the kitchen and inquired after my health. He informed me that my scion was injured and was in the dining room. I proceeded there, fed her, and healed her.
She looked at Yummy again.
She is insufferable.
I am, Yummy agreed. I am also your hero tonight.
There were a lot of subtexts in this conversation. I pulled it back to the line of questioning and addressed my next question to Yummy. Is that your blood in the entrance to the dining room?
It is,
Yummy said, her eyes on her mistress.
The shots were still striking the house. I shielded two women with my body and got them to safety. I was injured during that time.
You could have been killed, Ming said.
There was no silver in the bullets. I am strong, healthy, and well-fed by my generous and kind mistress.
Yummy drawled, locking eyes with Ming.
I healed well enough to bring others into safety and have them call the cops.
How many others? I asked.
Ming. The first two women, three men and two more women. Then the shooting stopped.
Did you at any time see anyone who might have assisted the shooter? I asked.
No,
they both said, more or less in unison. Did you hear anything that might suggest that someone inside was part of the attack?
No,
they said again. Did you smell anything non-human or peculiar before, during, or after the shooting? Both hesitated, but didn't glance at each other.
Possibly peculiar,
Ming said, after a moment that stretched too long.
But the river and cove are heavy with scent. Human partygoers wear a disgusting amount of perfume. The fire was odorous.
Yummy said, nothing out of the ordinary. Have there been any threats against you or the Mithrins of Knoxville? I asked.
Nothing out of the ordinary, Yummy repeated.
Ming said nothing. Will you provide documentation about any of the ordinary threats to Psyled?
Yes,
Yummy said, turning away from her mistress's eyes. I finished with my final question. Ming of Glass, are you aware that you were standing beside the senator and directly in front of the woman who died? That the first shot is believed to have missed everyone, deflected by the window glass? That you moved in the fraction of a second before the second shot, and that it struck the victim? Ming turned her gaze to me, pinning me to the chair. I felt like a bug on some collector's insect board. Holding this gaze was a lot harder than holding her ordinary gaze. This one made my skin want to crawl.
She died because of me,
Ming asked.
Because I moved. I was the target.
We haven't ruled that out. I scanned several pages and looked back up, having learned case details for the first time. Her name was Margaret Clayton Simpson. Did you know her?
I knew her grandmother. My clan does business with her husband, with his son, and with a Clayton uncle. I have a scion by the name of Clayton, whom you have met. I did not know Margaret personally except by name, and to shake her hand. She feared Mithrins. I do not force my presence on such humans.
Yummy said, I knew her name. That's it. We're leaving. I have to get my mistress home before dawn, and we'll just make it. They both stood and I followed only a half beat behind them. Will you contact us if you think of anything more? I pulled a card from my pocket and handed it to Yummy, who leaned in and accepted it. Thank you for your time, Ming of Glass.
You are welcome, Special Agent Ingram.
They turned to leave, and Yummy said over her shoulder,
Later, maggots.
Tandy smothered a laugh. I said, Ditto, Yummy. The blonde woman flinched just the tiniest bit.
Yummy,
Ming asked.
I'll explain later, my mistress.
Yummy tossed a glare my way and preceded her bloodsucker master out of the room and down the stairs. Tandy turned off the recorder and fell into the chair vacated by Ming, laughing. I gave him the same glare Yummy had given me.
Don't,
he said, holding his hands in a gesture of surrender. I could hardly believe this was the same man I had first met, when he was fresh out of spook school and fighting to stay sane in the presence of multiple people with conflicting emotions. I huffed out a breath. Okay. Were they telling the truth?
More or less. They have a very complicated relationship.
I gathered up the papers and stacked them neatly in the folder. Tell me something I don't know.
You're hungry. And sleep-deprived, and grieving. People died here, but I don't think you knew them. Who are you grieving for, Nellie?
Tears welled up in my eyes. I walked from behind the desk and toward the door, which Yummy had left open. An oak sapling? Never mind. I'm making my report to Rick and going home. Which I did. I walked into my cold, dark house just after dawn. Moving on muscle memory alone, I put winter wood into the firebox of the wood-burning cook stove that also heated my house and my water, topped off the hot water heater, mounted on the back, and turned the mousers out into the cold with orders to catch mice and rats. They stalked off, ignoring me except to give me dirty looks. Clearly, I was a bad mama. The water was tepid, but I showered off the long night, redressed in the flannel pajamas, wool socks, and slippers I had thrown off when the call came in about the shooting, and wrapped up in my faded pink blanket before joining the cats in the icy morning air outside. I sat on the intertwined roots of the sycamore and the poplar, roots that looked as if the trees were holding hands, fingers interlocked. I called them the married trees, and sitting there upon their clasped hands was the first place where I had communed with the land of Soulwood, my land, long before I knew what I was doing. 11 years ago I had come to this farm, escaping the leader of God's Cloud, who wanted me as his junior wife or concubine, to get away from Colonel Ernest Jackson, a pedophile and sexual predator. I had accepted a marriage proposal as a junior wife from John Ingram and his only remaining wife, Leah, and moved away from the church compound, away from my family, away from all I knew, to nurse Leah as she died. It had been a good bargain. I was 12 years old. A few years later, I legally married John. Our arrangement was completely without romance, a business proposition that had left me with the land after John sickened and passed away. Thought of in such bald terms, it was a horrible thing to have to do. But at the time, it had been like salvation shining down from heaven. When I agreed to marry into the Ingram household, I hadn't known I would inherit anything, and this small patch of land and these two trees was all I felt I could claim. It was where I'd gone when nursing duties for Leah had gotten to be too much, where I came even now when I wanted solace. I tucked my blanket around me, placed my palms flat on the frozen ground, and breathed out, letting the tension flow away. I could hear the faint click and hum of the windmill that powered my pump and sent water into the cistern. I could smell smoke from my fire, the faint and faraway stench of a polecat or skunk. Both should be sleeping, but perhaps a hungry hunting fox had risked the scent weapons for a chance to eat. I sank down through the bare ground into the roots of the trees. They were sleeping, the whole woods, all 150 acres that bordered the flat land around the house, up the steep hill and down into the gorge. All of it was in winter sleep, dormant, perhaps dreaming, if the earth and her plants dreamed. It was warm, deep in the darkness of the land, and the soul of the woods reached up to me, as if taking me by the hand. The woods embraced me, and I sighed out my misery, putting one hand to my belly to rub away the anxious feeling, the rooty scars deep inside, hard and unyielding. The woods didn't understand why I was sad, but they didn't care either. They wrapped me in their calm and peace, and I let the long night go. Much later, when the sky had grayed and whitened and blued, and the sun had risen over the hills, I pulled back from the sleeping land and turned my attention to Soulwood's problems. I nursed a failing patch of muscadine vine and told the land it was a good thing to send water up to the spring above the house. I searched out and checked on the pregnant bear that was hibernating in a split in the rock not far from the spring. Bolstered the health of the asparagus I had planted above the windmill 2 years past. I'd forgotten it, knowing that when it was ready to put forth enough shoots to eat, I'd remember. But now some kind of grubs had been chewing on its roots. I sent a pulse of energy to make them trundle away from the easy food source. When I had done all I could to nourish the land, and I couldn't put it off any longer, I turned my attention to the boundary between Soulwood and the church compound, to the dark, hollow place where the foreign entity once known as Brother Ephraim had carved out a space for his soul. It was still there, a little larger, a little more vile, a little more entrenched than before. The place he had carved out beneath the ground of Soulwood was dark and virulent, like a pocket of pus growing beneath perfect flesh, preparing to attack the entire organism. Brother Ephraim watched, silent. He had been my enemy and the enemy of my family for years.
He had been an evil, cruel, horrible man who used religion as an excuse to hurt women. When he came on my land to hurt me and had bled on Soulwood, I had fed him to the earth. That was my own special gift, to take the body and soul of humans and feed them to the land, to nourish it, to support it. I had fed Soulwood twice. The first time when a man had tackled me in the woods and tried to have his way with me, to get both my body and the land that came with it. I hadn't known the first man's name, had never even seen his face. But he had died fast and his essence had fed my land, making my trees grow strong and swiftly, so much that the forest now looked like old growth trees. I had thought taking Aphram would be the same, but either my land had rejected him or Brother Aphram had found a way to keep his consciousness intact, because the old pedophile and sexual predator was still here, an infection that I hadn't yet figured out how to kill. The last time I had studied him this intently, he had attacked me, a psychic attack that had been enough to kill me, had my land not deflected the hit. Soulwood had fought back, had protected me. This time as I watched him, Aphram did nothing, though I knew he was aware of me, aware and watching me back, planning something horrible and violent, some way to kill me or worse. Some way to trap me with him in his tiny cell. More thoroughly, more minutely, I examined the cave-like place he had carved out of my land. It was separated from Soulwood by a membrane that was much thicker than before. Soil that he had compacted, soil that he had sterilized. I feared that he'd learned how to do that from me. His one physical assault against my land, I had sealed off by salting the earth at the point of entry. The land there looked a lot like the land now around his hidey hole. It made it hard to see what was happening on the far boundary, shoved up against the church lands. But I slid my consciousness around to the side and pressed to the very edge of Soulwood. The membrane on the far side was thinner. Less structured than the membrane on my side. The membrane near the church was stretched out, sending long tendrils through the land, deep and down the cliff face onto the church grounds. Well, 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 I thought. Ewens is trying again, ain't ya? Trying to reach that vampire tree, trying to do something evil. I know it. I just don't know what you're planning yet. I reinforced the cell walls that encapsulated Brother Aphram on that side, thickening them, hardening them, making them as impervious as I could, studying their construction, because I was lying to myself. I knew what Aphram wanted. He wanted to contact the tree in the middle of the church grounds. The tree was part of his plan to bring harm to me. And the tree might actually have the ability to hurt me and to help Brother Aphram. The tree had once been an oak, but thanks to contact with my blood, it was now a devil tree, a vampire tree, growing vines and thorns and erupting rootlets from the grounds, roots that tried to grab little girls and boys' feet and pull them in, tried to stab any adult who intervened. It killed pets, puppies and kittens. It wanted blood, had ever since it tasted mine. It acted like a depraved and evil tree, but I had the feeling that the vampire tree had a purpose, needs, and desires. I had tried to give the tree a job, thinking that was all it wanted. But instead of doing what I encouraged it to do, the tree was still growing wild and acting out, killing, or trying to. The last time I'd been on church grounds, the tree was nearly 20 feet around. With serpentine roots like bark-covered boa constrictors petrified in place, leaves like some prehistoric succulent, and 4-inch thorns. It had eaten a bulldozer, had destroyed a concrete block fence, had resisted burning, chainsaws, explosives, and herbicides. I needed to figure out what it wanted and how to contain it. It and Brother Aphram. Until I figured all that out,
I once again choked off Ephraim's little tendrils with my reinforced wall. No way was I letting the tree that had once had access to my blood merge with my enemy. Satisfied that I had done all I could to contain Brother Ephraim, I pulled away from the boundaries of Soulwood and back into myself, to discover that I had become a daybed for the cats. Torquil was in my lap, curled between the blanket and me in a warm nest. Jesse was stretched across my shoulders. Cello had made a hammock of the blanket at my elbow and stretched out and twisted like melted taffy in what looked like an anatomically impossible position. I shooed them away, gathered up my blanket, and went inside. The house had warmed, and I turned on the slow-moving overhead fans to move the air around. The cats streaked ahead of me and ignored me when I told them they had a job to do outside. They leaped onto the bed and burrowed under the covers. I did not want to sleep with cats, but I was too tired to make them obey me and put them back outside. I turned on my brand new electric blanket and crawled in. And really, with three cats warm and purring, my new bed had never felt so good. Chapter 3. I was up at noon to let the cats out, add wood to the stove, and tumble back into bed. And I was up again at 3, the sunlight peeking through the blinds. I wasn't sure what species I was, but my kind didn't do well with lack of sleep, unless that lack of sleep was spent in the woods, communing with the trees. And even that had its own consequences. I started coffee in the new bun coffee maker, brushed my teeth, washed my face, and checked my... well, they weren't fingernails. Not anymore. My nails were slightly green, thicker at the nail beds than they had been, thinner at the tips, where they flattened out and spread into leaves, green leaves with distinct veins and curling tips. As part of my morning, afternoon ritual, I clipped my leaves. It had become part of my daily grooming habits, one that was even more necessary after time spent communing with the woods. I also clipped the leaves that tended to appear at my hairline at the nape of my neck. I liked the way they felt against my skin, but they tended to creep people out. A new phrase for me. Had I left my hair long, they wouldn't show, teaching me that some seemingly simple decisions often had long-term consequences. While gooping up my hair, I caught a glimpse of my eyes in the mirror. They were greener. I had noticed a color change a few weeks past, and it seemed to be accelerating. I wasn't sure I liked the color, and it too creeped out some people. But there wasn't anything I could do about it. I dressed in one of 5 mix-and-match outfits that worked for the office and the field, refilled my one-day go-bag and checked my messages, an act that had become SOP, Standard Operating Procedure. Since Unit 18 became part of my life, and the cell tower went up at the highest point of my land, there were 6 emails and double that many texts, one that had come while I was sleeping and informed me of a meeting at headquarters. I was likely to be late for that unit briefing. I had somehow slept through the group text, slumber claiming my brain and not letting go. As a probationary agent, I wasn't supposed to miss meetings, so I tossed some of my homemade granola into a plastic sealable bag and grabbed a carton of milk, which had horrified my mama the last time she was here. Good churchgoers drank only milk they took fresh out of the cow or goat, but I didn't have time to care for animals or barter for essentials, so packaged and processed foods had entered my diet. I was out the door, roaring down the mountain in my Chevy pickup in minutes, and was only a bit late to the meeting, even without turning on the new lights and siren mounted inside the cab and up on the roof. Rick had barely introduced the case and was giving a summary of the particulars when I thrust myself into my chair.
"Thank you for joining us, Proby,"
Rick said. I didn't much like apologizing for things I didn't do on purpose. Traffic and sleeping and horrible work hours seemed good reasons to be late. but I wouldn't say that unless pushed. And telling him I was late because I had to clip my leaves seemed unnecessarily comedic. I held in a grin and nodded.
"Something amusing to you, Broby?"
he asked. "Not a thing. Ewins was saying, because I'm listening, with all my ears," I said in church speak.
T-Lane coughed into her hand, covering an aggressive jaw as if trying to hide a laugh. She said,
"Our Nell's learned to snark." Her dark eyes sparkled, a sure sign I was going to bear the brunt of her wicked sense of humor.
"Nothing to learn, Tammy Lane," I said, knowing she hated her first name. "All church women learn how to speak the truth in ways that keeps them from getting the back of some man's hand."
"Ouch," she said.
I said back.
"To continue," Rick said, "we have 3 dead and 3 injured from a shooting at the home of Conrath and Carolyn Holloway. The party was a fundraiser for the political VIPs of East Tennessee."
I tuned him out except to listen for anything I didn't already know. I'd learned early on that repetition and more repetition was a big part of any investigation. There were good reasons for that, but it was still boring. Oakham's head dipped, his hair swung forward. He was watching me with hooded eyes, unblinking, concentrated. He didn't have to say a word for me to know what he was thinking. He'd sink his claws into any man who gave me the back of his hand. It warmed me all over, but it was a bit intense and I dropped my gaze. It settled on the coffee urn, on the table, and the metal travel mug in front of me. Someone had painted green leaves all over it. T-Lane, Tandy, somehow it felt like Tandy's work. That warmth inside me spiked. I knew a gift when I saw it. And then I realized that all our mugs had been artistically enhanced. Oakham's had a stylized spotted leopard on it. Rick's, a black leopard and the letters SAC. JoJo's had a caricature of her, wearing a red turban and dozens of earrings of every sort. T-Lane showed a hand holding a gray stone with a full moon behind it for her moon gift magics. Tandy's showed clouds and huge lightning bursts, which was kind of mean, as being struck by lightning had given his skin the red tracery and his gift of empathy. Sol's mug was undecorated except for the letters AD for Assistant Director of Psyled. But then not everyone knew that Sol was an arc-en-ciel, a rainbow dragon shapeshifter. That intel was need to know.
"Nell," Rick asked, "wool gathering?"
I thought back to what he had been saying. I said, "There was nothing in the land that I recognized. I included in my report about the dead plants and the sapling. Ming of Glass and Yump," her assistant, asked if the shooter was a vampire. "It wasn't. I have no idea what species it was except that it, he, I'm going with he, wasn't human."
"So you were listening,"
he said. "Not actively. I was hearing, but not listening. There's a difference."
Rick shook his head.
He looked tired, like he needed protein. Or like I made him tired. That was actually a possibility, since I had claimed him for Soulwood as part of healing the curse on his soul and body. His olive skin was paler than usual, and his black hair seemed streaked with more silver each time I saw him. Oddly, his white shirt needed ironing, and his pants looked like the same pair he had worn at the Holloways the night before, which meant he hadn't been home to sleep or shower or anything. I got up and found a protein bar in the drawer by the sink, tossed it to him. He caught it, looking from me to the bar, and dropped into his chair with a soft, drawn-out sigh.
"T-Lane?"
he asked, opening the package, taking a bite. T-Lane said, "I hung around the feds as much as I could. There was no sign of magical use in the house or on the investigators. All human, all the way. The feds didn't want to talk around me, so I put in earbuds and pretended to play with my phone. But in reality, I was wearing the new MMs. Rick looked interested. MMs were micro mics, a device dreamed up by JoJo.
They looked just like earbuds, but amplified noise like mega hearing aids. When hooked to a cell with the proper app, the ambient noise could be filtered out so that the wearer could hear and record any conversation the wearer wanted. Sometimes. Sometimes not. Jojo was still working out technical problems. MMs were likely illegal. They were certainly not something that could be used for evidence gathering, but they were handy when you wanted to be sneaky. Jojo had made two sets of the MMs, and Teen Lane had one, Rick had the other, though he probably already had better than human hearing, being Werecat. "And?" he asked. "Nothing from the feds. There's some kind of ambient hum at the Holloways. Maybe part of the security system? But I did get something from the security team when I went by the master suite. The hum disappeared there, and the guy in charge of the team, he has a drug problem, a gambling problem, and two girlfriends, and a wife." I gave the info to Jojo. We all turned to Joe, who said, "Deep background in process. Peter Simon is a former Green Beret, injured in a non-military exercise, I guess you'd call it, while on leave. He was jumping out of a plane and his parachute didn't open correctly. He survived the landing and made it through rehab, but he was on oxy for about 6 months, and it looks like he never kicked the habit. The addiction is what drove him out of the service, put his marriage into trouble, and gave him two ladies on the side. One may be his dealer. The other is pregnant with his baby. Making him a target for coercion or blackmail," Rick said. "What about the gambling problem?"
"Oakham has that one," Jojo said.
"Tennessee's gambling laws are some of the toughest in the country, and so Simon has no legal way to indulge. We got a warrant for his electronic history, and he has a bookie named TJ, just the initials, and nothing in the system on that name or any correlating name with those initials. It's going to take time and more time to do an electronic probe and analysis on all the particulars. I'm willing. But the feds have the people and the system in place to do a full electronic forensics workup, and they don't know about this angle yet. He's human. Giving this to the right federal agent in the right way could give us some negotiation room if we need it later," Rick mused. "Clean up the file and send it to me. I'll make a call."
Oakham nodded and started tapping on his tablet.
"Tandy?" Rick asked.
"Everyone has secrets," Tandy said slowly. "It's not hard to read past the natural protective emotional barriers of most humans and paranormals, but unless the interviewer asks the right questions..."
He looked around the table.
"The emotional reactions are not exactly easy to interpret. Everyone we interviewed at the party had secrets. That said, I didn't pick up on guilt that might be related to the shooting."
I had tuned in to Tandy's report as he spoke. Only weeks past, the empath had been a bundle of nerves and emotional pain. The not-so-secret affair with Jojo was doing him a world of good.
"But you did pick up on other guilt?" Rick asked.
"Several who were currently having affairs. One who was feeling guilty about something at his job, maybe embezzling. Several with substance abuse problems, three with anger issues. One couple with domestic abuse issues. I amended the reports on each of them, and Joe is checking them out."
"Joe, dig deeper into all the things Tandy picked up. If you can substantiate it, then make sure the domestic abuse is turned over to whatever agency can best address it,"
Rick said.
"If the embezzlement is likely, see it goes to the DA for consideration of further investigation. The affairs, substance abuse, and anger issues are out of our bailiwick, unless they indicate a tie to the shooting. That all, people?"
When no one spoke up, Rick said,
"You all know your assignments. Go. Stir the nests. Keep your eyes open."
Once the meeting was over, the others took off into the field to continue follow-up interviews, visits to the city morgue, and higher-level meetings with the FBI and ATF, and assorted law enforcement organizations. The probie had no such fun assignments, and Jojo was too important at IT operations to be wasted on basic field drudgery,
so the two of us were relegated to the office. I spent the late afternoon in my little cubicle reading over the speech-to-text interviews and correcting mistakes. Jojo continued digging through a surface background check of all the partygoers tapped by Tandy to see if anything pointed to problems that might have resulted in a crime of passion or crime of profit. And once those exciting and dangerous, not at all, assignments were done, Jojo and I began to create a working, searchable Bible of the crime, the people who had been injured, the party guests, the caterers, and the security personnel, with strong concentration on Peter Simon, the head security guy, the one with the substance abuse problems, woman problems, baby problems, and problem problems. It was boring and tiresome, but listening on earbuds while reading the transcripts on an electronic reader did give me time to water all the plants I had started in the office and stick my fingers into their soil, giving them a little boost to make them thrive. In front of each window, I had planted a mixed assortment of plants, and we now had access to spinach and 3 varieties of lettuce, a dozen varieties of basils, mints, chives, thymes, and other edible herbs. Rick had grumbled that I was using the office as a greenhouse, and since he was right, I hadn't argued. But I needed the fresh greens to offset the impact of fast foods on my system, and the others had quickly learned how to augment their own meals with the fresh stuff and asked for tomatoes, cukes, and squash. I wasn't sure how I'd grow all that with the limited light in HQ, but the fresh food sounded wonderful. An hour after sundown, I made black China tea with lemon mint and brought mugs in the carafe to Jojo with my notes. She didn't look up, but sipped her tea, which was made to her specifications, with lots of sugar and no cream. "Mmm," she said on an exhale. "I wondered if you were going to stop farming and start working today, you lazy girl." She was teasing me. It had taken a bit of time to learn that insults and what the team called snark were actually bonding friendship rituals. I still wasn't good at responding to it. But now I knew what it was, and my feelings didn't get tangled up in the repartee. I was checking the reports. I found only a few errors so far, and most of them are mine. Clementine doesn't like my accent. Clementine was the name given to the new voice-to-text software, which was much easier to say than CLMT2207. Jojo blew out a laugh through her nose. "Yours and mine both, Chicky. I think the designer was British and male. Black and female weren't on his radar when he input his regional pronunciation, intonation, and enunciation modulations." I held in a grin at the quote. Hillbilly was even less on his radar. Still, I think the new software is pretty good. Anything that keeps me from being the unit's transcriptionist is good by me. Jojo, who was really Special Agent Josephine Anna Jones, stretched in her chair, throwing her arms up and arching her spine.